I'm America's digital pro, Kim Komando. And hey, did you know something? October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month. That's right. So I wanted to use this episode of Komando on Demand to introduce you to a good friend of mine. He's a renowned attorney, too. His name is Stephen Tepler. He hosts a really great podcast called Cyber Law Now. Cybersecurity and privacy is so important that I wanted to share a recent episode of Cyber Law. And this is the one where Stephen Tepler talks to a retired FBI special agent, a guy by the name of Lawrence Wolfenden. They're going to talk about his inside experiences with electronic privacy issues during his whole career, as well as what the government can and cannot do when it comes to protecting our privacy. I'm telling you, this is a great podcast. You're going to love every minute of it. It's packed with such useful information and stories. I just didn't want you to miss it. Before we get started, a special thank you goes out to our partners in the podcast because they make this podcast possible.
Online privacy. Is there really such a thing in today's everything goes and everything gets posted digital world? Is privacy bad or good? And for who? When did we even start being concerned with privacy? What laws protect our privacy or take it away? What about our children? What if I told you that the last federal law protecting people from cyber intrusion was passed in the 1980s, before there was even an internet, or that the only federal child protection law is now 20 years old and hasn't been updated, or that our computerized election systems are at risk, and that most of the laws passed since protect companies and not individuals, or that companies want to keep you from suing them in court if they're responsible for privacy invasions or cybercrime? Sounds paranoid, doesn't it? Want to learn more about cyber protection laws and how they affect you, our nation, and your family? Join me, Stephen Tepler, on the Cyber Law Now podcast, where I'll be joined by retired FBI Special Agent Lawrence Wolfenden of the Silent Group in Sarasota, Florida.
Malicious software. Coward. The red folks are coming.
They say we are not prepared.
Spying, snooping.
It's scary.
Hi, I'm attorney Stephen Tepler, and welcome to the Cyber Law Now podcast. I chair the cybersecurity and privacy practice at the Mandelbaum Salzburg Law Firm. Here at Cyber Law Now, we discuss today's cybersecurity, look at the legal issues around them, and make you aware of them, how they affect you, and what you can do to protect yourself. We are absolutely thrilled to have as today's guest retired FBI Special Agent Lawrence Wolfenden, who is a privacy and cybersecurity and cyber forensics expert at the Silent Group in Sarasota, Florida. Lawrence, welcome, and tell us a little bit about what you do.
Thank you, Stephen. So I am was hired as a senior forensics examiner with Silent Group. I had been with the FBI as a special agent for 25 years when I retired in January of 2017, and had worked as a white-collar crime investigator is where I started out, moved into doing digital forensics, was one of the FBI's certified forensic examiners in their computer analysis and response team, helped develop the standard operating procedures that we had for the field examiners, worked on a lot of Linux-type cases, Linux forensics, Linux-based forensics, and eventually moved into working on cyber fraud, internet fraud, and cyber intrusions, which when I started was focused mainly on criminal intrusions, but then eventually moved on to doing national security-type intrusions. So when I retired in 2017, I had known the folks at Silent for quite some time, probably about 10 years at that point, having had worked with them on some different intrusion cases. And they were able to bring me on board to some respect, do the same thing I had done before, digital forensics and investigations of network intrusions.
That's incredible, Lawrence. I'm sure that your 25 years of experience has exposed you to a variety of situations, and I guess some of them you can't talk about. But to the extent you do, what was possibly the most interesting privacy issue that you had seen during your tenure at the FBI?
One, I guess I would have to say, was one that kind of hit home, and that is the OPM intrusion. So I was part of the FBI's CAT team, which is their cyber action team. I was part of the CAT team, the cyber action team, which essentially is sort of a fly team of agents out in the field, one or two from each office, and were the guys who were identified as being particularly adept at working intrusion investigations, so that whenever there was a problem that needed a high level of expertise, maybe needed extra manpower thrown at it, they could draw upon those folks in the field. We had worked together on cases in the past, could get out to where a problem might be occurring and begin investigating it. So the Office of Professional Management in 2015 had been suffered an intrusion, apparently by foreign actors, and the CAT team was called to come out and assist in responding and trying to identify who it was that had come in, how far into the network they had gotten, what they had stolen, whether or not they were still there, how we could get them out, and maybe to be able to identify precisely who it was and decide on what kind of response should be brought to bear. And the nature of that work was basically they brought in the CAT team to work for about a two-week period, at which point, given that the number of days you're working and the number of hours that you're working per day, you tended to get burned out, and we would then cycle in new people to come in and work, let us get back to working our own cases back in our own office. So during that initial response, we were trying to identify who it was that had gotten in there, how they had gotten in there. But the privacy aspect of it was that one of the things that we were able to determine that it appeared that they were targeting at the OPM was the background information, the personnel files of U.S. government workers, including every FBI agent. So this was something that where one of the few times I worked where I was not only an investigator, but also potentially a victim. And the issue was is that these were our, this was included the data that was the basis for the background investigations that are used to determine whether or not agents could receive a security clearance and what level of security clearance. So when you're preparing to do your background investigation, you provide information, the basic stuff, your name, your date of birth, your social security number, but also every place you've ever lived. You provide information about, anybody that you've ever had a relationship with for more than, lived with for more than 30 days. So roommates, your wife, spouse, your children. You provide information about relatives, immediate family relatives, and their spouses. Just pretty much everything under the sun so that a determination could be made whether or not you were going to be able to receive a top secret security clearance. So all that information was right there, housed in the housed in databases that were at the within the OPM's network, and it had been apparently exfiltrated out to a foreign country, basically a gold mine of for any foreign intelligence service to mine.
How many people were had their information exposed through the OPM data breach?
That's a good, I don't know the precise number. The statement generally was anybody who had applied for a security clearance with the U.S. government I don't know what the time limit was, whether it was 10 years, 15 years, or 20 years. But it was devastating loss.
There are reports that there are as many as tens of millions of identities compromised. And these include all kinds of federal employees, not just FBI agents, but undercover agents, other types of confidential informants, the types of personal information that, if disclosed, could actually endanger somebody's life. So we're now at the pivot and looking at privacy and how privacy has affected us in our everyday lives. So we all hear about privacy issues in our personal information, and certainly your personal information that might have been compromised as a result of the OPM data breach. What are your existing concerns today about personal privacy and the information that we all keep on gathering and increasing on the internet, online, through various platforms and computers and applications and chat groups, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, that's kind of interesting, because as I conduct investigations and also just as I live my life, trying to educate my wife and my children about how they need to be careful, and also personally want to be careful about sharing my own information out. It is astounding how freely and how widespread we give up information that normally would be considered very private. Facebook is a wonderful example. I mean, people are putting incredible amount of detail regarding their life, regarding who their friends and associates are, what they do on a day-to-day basis, into platforms like Facebook. And they're by no means the only one. There's Tumblr and Imgur and Instagram. People, sometimes are more well known for their digital life than their personal life. It's kind of interesting to think about folks who, have, according to some of these platforms, they have 10,000 friends or 100,000 friends. I think that's kind of interesting, because I really can probably name only about 50 people that I would consider, quote, friends. A lot of acquaintances, but they're not all my friends, and I wouldn't share the same level of detail regarding my personal life with everybody I've ever come in contact with. But over as a society, we seem to be doing that more and more, and it's in ways that we see. So, like the social media platforms, where we are cognizant and deliberately taking pictures and posting them. Maybe sometimes it's a little more indirect from the standpoint that I didn't take and post something, but my friends that I'm with, we're out at a restaurant and they take some pictures and post them on their Facebook account. So now all of a sudden I'm up on there, even though I didn't really necessarily want to be. Couple that with some of the facial recognition technologies where it could be the people at the table next to me took a picture and posted it up, and now all of a sudden my face is recognized marked and tagged on some of the social platforms. But then you look at some things that people don't necessarily always think about. A lot of us take advantage of Google's Gmail service, or Yahoo's mail service, or AOL. There are a lot of free email services, and many of them are scanning the emails that they then sell the data to business partners so that you can receive targeted ads. Google was doing that up until last year, 2017. They decided to back off of that and no longer scan your emails and sell that data to partners for advertising purposes. when I was reading about that, I did note that it didn't necessarily say that they weren't scanning it and using it for other purposes. Maybe it's not for targeted ads anymore, but there are other there's other value in the data about what it is that we talk about, who it is we talk to, the places we go, the things we want to be. Marketing is a huge business, and getting a marketing message to a particular person, there's a huge financial incentive to do that. Let's face it, it's marketing and advertising. It was the engine that financed television. And think about how large that industry is. And it's all based on the fact that people wanted to get a marketing message, an advertising message to potential customers. And back then with TV, you didn't have the ability to target to the very specific people because it was just broadcast to everybody.
And today, Google is that model on steroids.
Okay, when we come back, Stephen will continue his conversation with retired Special Agent Lawrence Wolfenden about online privacy and what it means to you. But first, a word from one of our podcast partners.
Welcome back to the Cyber Law Now podcast. I'm attorney Stephen Tepler, and I am really excited to have retired FBI Special Agent Lawrence Wolfenden of the Silent Group here on the podcast. We're talking about privacy and the law and how it affects your everyday digital life. We were talking about Google and how it had been scanning your emails for certain purposes, but maybe they're still scanning emails for other purposes, and the marketing of these emails and anything that you place on the internet or use that they can capture becomes fodder to send to someone who may find value in it. That's a privacy issue, I think, and there's really no law that says you can't do that. There's no general privacy law in the United States. You know, in privacy, let's look at what privacy really is. Privacy at its core means that a person has control over his or her personal data. And control means that a person can claim control over the collection, the use, and the sharing of their data. And by sharing these days, we mean the sale of their data. When you buy that TV or you buy that refrigerator that's connected, that oven that's connected, that oven is sending information about what you're doing, how you cook, when you cook, and that information is useful and valuable to somebody. So bring this back to our conversation, Lawrence. Do we really have any privacy?
I would contend it's very difficult to maintain privacy. Like I said, most of us, probably most of us, make use of some of these free email services, and those have the capability of being scanned. If you look through the terms of service, you may actually, by connecting various apps and services to your free email, you may actually be allowing some third party to go through and look at and mine the data that's inside of your emails. In fact, I was reading one article where they said that that when you look at the actual details of what may be happening, it's not even necessarily just some computer program that's scanning for keywords or pulling things out like that, but actual individual human beings sitting down and reading through the emails that you've made available to them. You have no idea who these people are. You have no idea why they're looking at it, what they're reading, and what they may be doing with it. But you've given them permission to do it because you clicked through a 30-page terms of service agreement in order to connect this up. So they've asked for your permission and you've given it. I'm just not so sure that you've actually given it knowingly. I mean, you've knowingly given it up, but you don't know exactly the extent of what you've given up.
You're bringing up an issue that I've been thinking about during our conversation, and that is most of this data slurping is being done by private companies, you know, Facebook, Apple, Google, whatever. There's also an undercurrent of opinion and people who think that the government is reading everything and looking at everything and looking at your emails and scanning for, you know, for whatever it is that they think they're scanning for. I personally think that my life is not that important, that the government really doesn't care unless I don't pay my taxes. And then they're not going to scan for my emails. They're going to come knocking at my door. But my question to you, sir, is, and it's kind of a loaded question, and that is, did the FBI ever just wantonly or randomly decide that they want to look at somebody's emails and hack into their computers?
No. I did often get those kinds of questions of people that were concerned that the FBI is reading every email or scanning every email or listening to phone calls on a wholesale basis. And having been inside of the Bureau, it was very readily apparent that we quite frankly just don't have the manpower to do something like that. And I often explained it by saying, listen, there's about 10,000 to 13,000 FBI agents. When I started, it was about 10,000. Now it's about 13,000 actual agents in the FBI. There's 330 million people in the U.S. If you do the math, it's just not conceivable that we can keep tabs on everybody in this country, not without saying, okay, well, I can spend 10 seconds considering each person every other month. And then maybe, yeah, you could, but that's not meaningful. And it's, I hate to use the word ludicrous, but it's just not possible. But the other thing is that we're precluded from looking at things on a wholesale basis. I mean, the Constitution makes it very clear that in order for us to look into the private effects of an individual, whether that be by stopping them on the street and patting them down and pulling things out of their pocket and reading notes that might be in their wallet or in their briefcase or going into their house. But that also has been extended to apply to their emails and their online, their digital records. Obtaining those things requires, at the least, it requires a grand jury subpoena. And in many, many cases, to get to something that is meaningful and useful in a criminal investigation or a national security investigation, it actually requires either a search warrant for criminal investigations or a FISA warrant for national security investigations. And those take, number one, time to produce. You have to put a lot of documentary evidence and support behind asking for those things. And the application then goes to a third-party arbitrator, so a judge. In criminal court, or in the criminal side, it's a United States magistrate in most cases. Sometimes it's a United States judge. In others, in the FISA side, it is a judge on the FISA court. So it's a third-party independent arbiter. Granted, they are a judge. They are a member of the U.S. government. But they are independent of the executive branch. They're independent of the FBI, the Department of Justice. And I've had warrants get turned down. The judges are by no means a rubber stamp. And the more intrusive the request, the more scrutiny they provide to it. So, for example, if I wanted if I just want to know information about your internet service. So I want to know who it is you have internet service for and how long you've had it. I can get that with a grand jury subpoena. If I want to know about the emails that you've been sending, I'm going to have to get a search warrant. There are some there are some ways that I can obtain old emails, but in general, I'm going to have to, without getting a warrant, but in general, I'm going to have to get a search warrant to get your emails, which means I have to explain what it is you did that I think is a criminal violation when you did it and how your emails relate to it. And I've got to make a showing to a judge that there's probable cause, that it's more likely than not that the evidence is actually in your emails. And then if I want to go one step further and actually read your emails or your chat communications real time as you're having them, then I have to actually get a Title III warrant, which is a significant hurdle to overcome. You have to provide a lot of data. You generally have to get a search warrant before you can get a Title III warrant. You have to make a showing that the information is current and is still ongoing. And then you have to make reports to the judge every 10 days about what it is you're collecting. It's a very difficult process. And if every agent in the FBI had a Title III that they were supervising and collecting information on, the FBI would not be doing anything else at all except working on those.
Okay, it's super interesting to see what the government can access in regards to our online information, isn't it? We're going to get right back to the conversation with Stephen and Lawrence after we hear from some of the good companies who help make this podcast possible.
Welcome back to Cyber Law Now. In the past segment, you've heard about what the FBI can and can't do, and contrary to a lot of what we're hearing today, the FBI has to obey the law, and it has to get subpoenas to get information. There are varying levels of requirements and what I guess we would call probable cause or good cause for any kind of subpoena or warrant or arrest that might be made in connection with digital information. And we'll talk about cell towers and perhaps the FISA court at another time, but Lawrence is teaching us that this is not a walk into court and just like you see on TV, they give it a rubber stamp and there you go, let's capture the computer. There has to be a reason. There has to be a reasonable suspicion of some sort of criminal activity. Lawrence, we're coming close to the end of our podcast and I do hope that you'll come back for another follow-up on this because, boy, I have a ton of questions for you, and I'm a lawyer. And we can go over some of the constitutional issues and some of the recent events that have raised eyebrows in terms of how information is disclosed or not disclosed, both on the government side as well as on the private side. But talk a little bit about getting a FISA warrant. That's the tell us a little bit about the FISA court, perhaps, if you can.
Sure. So, and I'll have to preface this by saying that I have not myself obtained a FISA warrant. I have worked with National Security Letters, which are the foreign counterintelligence equivalent analogy to a grand jury subpoena. So a lower threshold to obtain those, but at the same time, you get a lesser level of information from those. But basically, the from watching other people and assisting other agents in obtaining FISA warrants and building those up, in order to get a search warrant, you have to prepare an affidavit in which you lay forth your background, the facts of the case, and explain how it is that the information which you seek is in fact in the place where you want to search and how it does in fact relate to the crime being described.
And Lawrence, let me point out as a lawyer that when you file an affidavit or fill out an affidavit, you're making a sworn statement to a federal court. And if you lie to that federal court, the consequences can be grave. And if you're, I guess, an FBI special agent, you can be disciplined and perhaps even suspended or worse. Am I correct?
You are correct. Disciplined at the least if you make a mistake and mislead the court or it's felt that you didn't make it clear what was going on. You know, if you try to be disingenuous with the court, that's going to come back to bite you professionally. potentially to the point where you may not be in a position to ever testify anymore, which pretty much cuts off being able to work on any kind of criminal investigation.
Kind of cuts your career in half, doesn't it?
It pretty much cuts your career in half. If it's, there is also all the way to the potential of being prosecuted if you make a deliberate false statement to the court. The sanctions and the penalties can be quite severe. You can see your career end, and you could actually potentially even go to jail, just like anybody else who lies to the court can wind up being in jail. So, if you with the search warrant, you put all the information into your affidavit and present it to the judge. With the FISA warrant, it is very similar, except that it goes through such a level of scrutiny within the FBI before it even gets over to the Department of Justice, who scrutinizes it, before it ever goes to the FISA court, where a judge is going to have the opportunity to scrutinize it and render his own decision as an independent third party, that the requirement is that every sentence, every fact that you put into your FISA warrant has to be backed up by some sort of documented evidence that's in the file. So whereas I can, to some extent, rely on memory and reports and summations of reports, put it into an affidavit, and it's my own professionalism that is on the line. With the FISA warrant, it goes that next step of I have to be able, for every single line in my affidavit, to be able to point to a particular document that is saved. It can't be just something in my memory. It can't be something I surmised. I have to actually go back and see where it is in the file. That process and the reviews to make that happen are long and arduous, and quite frankly, are a disincentive to get a FISA warrant because it's so difficult.
So here's my takeaway on this. My takeaway, and you're reinforcing, at least from my perspective, the belief that the government pretty much does a better job at trying to protect information than big business does. Or then the big tech companies might. We've been to law school and law enforcement school today with FBI Special Agent Lawrence Wolfenden of the Silent Group. We've learned that while the United States doesn't have explicit privacy statutes for Americans, although hopefully when Lawrence returns in our subsequent segment and podcast, we can learn more. There are legal protections that can help make sure that you, your family, and the people who you love are safe from bad actors and cyber criminals. So I want to thank you so much, Lawrence, for joining us today. I hope to have you back for that next segment on Cyber Law Now podcasts. And thank you, our listeners, for your interest in going to law school. Don't forget to hit subscribe and get all of your podcasts while you sleep. Share them with your friends, even. If you have a cyber law subject you want to hear more about, contact us. And this is Attorney Stephen Tepler.